Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. America's Liberty Birth Month of July is paradoxically named after a Roman dictator. The USA is 245 years old and accorded a Caesarean birth, ripped out of the imperialistic womb of its mother country by traitors honored as this nation's first patriots. Today's program commemorates two prominent symbols and singularities of American democracy, which I wrote and syncretize, the vote and the flag. The American century that never quite materialized will probably not expand into an American millennium, nor the 21st century as quite the liberty centennium that has been ardently proclaimed. America is always at war with itself. It is a perpetual battleground of dissent and disparity. Personal and political freedom have not been easy or stable achievements, nor justice anything but bitter and often bloody conflict between those who would extend the rights of democracy and those who would restrain them. Our venerated ancestors insisted these rights and liberties would grow and nurture in this Yankee Doodle democracy. Yet anyone who smugly assumes the USA to be the essential seedbed of worldwide human rights and liberty is wrongheaded in a most sublime degree. The USA is not a triumphant exemplar of democracy, but a perpetual work in progress and retrogression, always immersed in revolution and civil war about democracy. And yes, indeed, America is once again in need of a revolution to thwart incipient treachery and tyranny and the blatant attempt by some of its own avaricious citizens, whom the original constitutionalists warned against, from obliterating democracy. This necessary revolution is underwritten in the nation's principles and is as sweeping in its implications as the original revolt against the rule of kings, which was corrupt, despotic, and hubristic. This revolution is within the law. It is supported by the law, in design, if precariously in practice. And the law, in a very real sense, provides its mechanics and depends on it to maintain its legitimacy. This revolution is more binding than the ancient right to remove emperors in old China or revolt against kings and church in medieval Europe. This revolution is the vote, guaranteed after much bitter struggle and constitutional amendment to all citizens, which, unfortunately, too many abuse by disuse even more than by corruption and repressive voting laws that are once again ruthlessly being implemented to disenfranchise racial minorities and members of an opposing political party through gerrymandering, among other onerous sleight-of-hand regulations. On average, less than 50% of eligible voters in the USA vote, essentially from disgust or a sense of disillusion, powerlessness, or alienation. Much of that discontent might be alleviated by honest efforts to ensure the right of every citizen eligible to vote, that their vote matters and would not be discarded or tampered with by corrupt Machiavellians or by unconstitutional legislation. These recent prohibitive voting laws, which are mainly racist, must be counteracted by vigorously registering to vote the many millions who are being disenfranchised and to dispute the quasi-legal theft of their most basic right as citizens. If these hundreds of millions of ordinary people who are denied their right to vote were to literally rise up and demand their constitutional rights, despite the attempted lawless threat and corruption, they will discover the shallowness of the sham to decertify their citizenship and realize that they are able to transform much of what has gone off track in the nation's recent history. The late great Black Moses, surnamed Robert, who died this past Sunday at age 86, helped lead Mississippi blacks out of Jim Crow slavery and ignorance and reestablished their 15th Amendment right to vote. Bob Moses, the indefatigable civil rights organizer, knew very well the mathematical value and necessity of the vote for black liberation. He organized rural poor blacks in Mississippi during the civil rights era of the 1960s to vote at great risk of his own life and the cost of allies, in particular, three murdered civil rights volunteers by the KKK. And now, part two of this diatribe. An influenza epidemic plagues the USA alongside COVID-19. Carriers of the virus commit personal and political forms of flagellation by denouncing conflagration of Old Glory while shedding the Bill of Rights as though they were a toxic infestation. The legalistic argument to categorize flag abuse as illegal is that the First Amendment only protects expression, quote-unquote, not the conduct, quote-unquote, of expression. That seems like saying everyone has as many rights as they choose unless they use them, which automatically constitutes their abuse. But it is obviously an inverse form of patriotism to sanctify the flag as a religious relic. And it is just as obvious that the very self-anointed patriots who zealously demand obeisance to flag worship are busily trampling on the rights and freedoms for which the flag allegedly stands. A heretical premise that free speech must be censored and the symbols of liberty enshrined as holy icons while criminalizing irreverence to the stars and stripes. Flags are everywhere, in public places, of course, but they bloom also from houses, offices, automobiles, stenciled on t-shirts, and worn on lapel pins. Flag pins are especially de rigueur for political figures, perhaps even clasped to their bedtime pajamas and nightgowns. These persistent and nagging proclamations of Americanhood, which might appear reasonable, though rude in a foreign country, seem flagrantly discriminatory and shabbily neurotic here at home, an insidious plethora of swastikification. Most people who feel compulsion to mark themselves with a flag most likely do believe in freedom and democracy for themselves and those they regard as like themselves. But it is doubtful they feel the same passion about the rights and liberties of others who practice a different religion or none, or who have a different skin color, or are obvious immigrants from non-Western countries. The flag conceals more than it illuminates. Its red stripes represent the blood shed by the early patriots, who, if anyone needs to be reminded, were traitors and radical secessionists. The stars are symbols of conquest, the brutal and chauvinistic displacement of a native civilization by imperialistic usurpers. And the white stripes sanitize inequities sewn into the fabric of white nationalism and genocide. Some citizens veil themselves with flags, merging self-perceived inadequacies and abortive ambitions disguised by fervent nationalism and racial supremacy. underneath the patriotic bunting can be sensed the grim frenzy and unforgiving intolerance for new ideas and those who engage in them. The pledge of allegiance to the flag that school children must say every day, which contains the phrase, "One nation under God," is the national school prayer. A flag, after all, is a national totem, relatively unsophisticated in an expanding global civilization, in which such iconoclastic relics of humanity's immaturity should be displayed in museums with other primitive relics and tribal totems. Yet people still do get upset when someone trods on the red, white, and blue, or blows a nose on its stars and stripes. Making shirts of flags or burning them in public protest gives police and military veterans, not all, apoplexy. 100% Americans think flag burners should be shot. Patriots, discontented, confused souls who think their personal lives would vastly improve if the USA dominated the world, roar with anger and anguish because desecrating the flag is protected by the Constitution's guarantee of free speech, which is in character with the precepts of democracy. A piece of cloth, whatever its mythological imperative, is not to be placed above human rights. What is freedom worth if in dissent against its abject dissolution, its symbols cannot be dramatically abused? Symbols are powerful. They define purpose, pull people together, but separate them also. Despite the vagaries of the current pandemic and its human-precipitated climate change, humanity is crossbreeding at an incredible rate, which renders primitive icons of separateness increasingly meaningless. Our species will truly be free when it is able to abandon the symbols that perpetuate its divisions and combine unity and strength of will to defeat the combined catastrophes threatening life on the planet. The many tribes no longer need their special banners and bunting, except as family talismans put away for memory. Spitting on a flag erroneously claims its continuance as totemic relevance. Why should anyone care if someone burns a flag, urinates, or makes love on one? Hegel, the Nazis' favorite philosopher, thought people should only be slaves to the state. The flag, as the state's holy icon, must therefore be sanctified, and death to whomever sullies it. Not death yet in the USA, but once denounced as a criminal act, defiling the flag moves into similar realms of punishment and autocratic subjection. Flag worship is a psychotic defect of the modern world, an imperious abstraction that purports to represent some dim and generally fallacious perception of tradition and glorified manifest destiny of myth that spreads as though it were a lethal virus, which it too often is. Flag worship is not only stupid, but is also stale jingoism. Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, Samuel Johnson wrote in the 18th century. With all due respect to Dr. Johnson, I beg to submit that patriotism is the first refuge of a scoundrel, Ambrose Bierce, author of The Devil's Dictionary, wrote a century later. And now, by Michael Schaffner. I'm a reenactor. Critical race theory helps me bring U.S. history, good and bad, to life. I'm a historical reenactor. As such, I portray soldiers from various of the United States' past conflicts, including the American Revolution and the War of 1812. On a recent weekend, I participated in a living history at a historical site in Maryland. The event was a delight for several reasons, including the fact that I got to reunite with friends I had not seen in a year and a half, all of us kept away from one another by the pandemic. It was 1776. Over 2 days, I interacted with scores of people while enlisting, quote unquote, them for the Maryland militia. Quite a bit of pen work was involved, and my quills and skills, such as they are, got a serious workout. I even repointed a couple of quills in the field, a first and necessary when the recruiting includes handing them over to a motley assortment of harried parents, urchins, and random passers-by to sign the muster roll. But there were more serious matters to consider, too, specifically the question of how to interpret a site connected with both enslavement and the Declaration of Independence. Let me be clear. I love my country. I love it as much as anyone who views initiatives such as the New York Times' 1619 Project and the teaching of critical race theory as threats. But I also love history and believe the histories of too many Americans have been left untold, while much of the rest has been pitified to make the more privileged among us feel better about ourselves. So I found myself explaining, for example, that the Declaration itself lists among King George's sins that, quote, he has excited domestic insurrection among us, unquote, a direct reference to the escape or revolt of enslaved African Americans, and further, that the southern colonies that depended on the labor of enslaved people would not have agreed to sign the Constitution without representation in the House based on partial credit for such property. Moreover, while I like representing a defender of our independence, I also know that as a militiaman, I served as the muscle of the 18th century white middle class, equally ready to browbeat striking dock workers, despoil indigenous peoples, and repress the first sign of resistance among the enslaved. An honest interpretation requires embracing the moral ambiguity of participating in that day's systemic racism. That's not what many have learned, nor perhaps what they want to hear on their day off. But were I to fail to mention it, I would be betraying the memory of those less remembered Americans, as well as that of the fellow I would have been nearly 250 years ago. He was not a two-dimensional patriot, entirely composed of virtues, but a faithful servant of his community at both its best and its worst. Ideally, one presents these truths without shame, for what can't be changed, and with an invitation to reflect on today's realities in light of the lingering damage. Because it is quite possible to love our country while allowing for new critical narratives, just as we love others despite their faults because of their saving virtues. And one truth about the United States is that we all should know enslavement was an unmitigated evil with toxic consequences to this day, and that an independence and republic in which only a small number of white male property owners wielded power was rife with hypocrisy, violence, and oppression. Yet my job doesn't end there, because the other truth is that we still love the United States because its virtues include existential promises that can be neither effaced nor ignored. All people are equal. A democratic republic is the optimum form of government, and the government of we the people is the truest, most effective way to collectively achieve the essential goals of the common defense and general welfare. Our shortfalls wouldn't matter so much in other countries because the same promises aren't the very reason for their existence. And it is the commitment to these promises that makes us Americans. To recoil from examining the gap between the promises and the reality is an American trait also, perfectly natural, though not as likely to move us toward an ever more perfect union. Examining the faults and shortcomings accompanying those promises should not divide us or make us hate each other. Such examination is a basic function of citizenship, and it comes with the responsibility to overcome our imperfections and carry on the eternal struggle for equality. Immersing ourselves in the fullest version of our history is one way to take responsibility. Another is to keep the essential promises we make to each other as fellow citizens, and to keep each other honest about it. And that was by Michael A. Schaffner. I am a reenactor. Critical race theory helps me bring U.S. history, good and bad, to life. Michael A. Schaffner, who wrote that, is working on the history of the 2nd Regiment, United States Colored Infantry, raised in Arlington in 1863. And he wrote this for the Washington Post. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. Piano intro by Keith Jarrett. I think I should end this Liberty Month with the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified in July 1868. It granted citizenship to, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States, unquote, which included former slaves, recently freed by the Civil War of 1861-65. It also forbids states to deny any person, quote, life, liberty, or property without due process of law, unquote, or, end quote again, deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, unquote. And that means the entire USA and its colonies, possessions, mandates, or whatever they may be called. And though we don't like it, the plague is replaguing us as a result of politicizing disease in the USA. So we all must do the obvious: vaccinate, isolate, and mask up wherever proper.